Listen to the conversation between the man and the woman and answer the questions.
Hello, Paragliders Paradise. How can I help you?
Oh, hi. I'm interested in doing a course in paragliding.
Which course are you interested in?
Well, I'm not sure. What's available?
Well, we've got the introductory course, which lasts for 2 days.
Okay.
Or there's the 4-day beginner's course, which is what most people do first. I'd tend to recommend that one. And there's also the elementary pilot course, which takes 5 to 6 days, depending on conditions.
We might try the beginner's course. What sort of prices are we looking at?
The introductory is $190. The beginner's course, which is probably what you'd be looking at, is $320. No, sorry, $330. It's just gone up. And the pilot course is $430.
Right.
And you also have to become a member of our club so that you're insured. That'll cost you $12 a day. Everyone has to take out insurance, you see.
Does that cover me if I break a leg?
No, I'm afraid not. It's only third party and covers you against damage to other people or their belongings, but not theft or injury. You would need to take out your own personal accident insurance.
I see. And what's the best way to get to your place? By public transport, or could we come by bike? We're pretty keen cyclists.
It's difficult by public transport, though there is a bus from Newcastle. Most people get here by car, though, because we're a little off the beaten track. But you could ride here, okay? I'll send you a map. Just let me take down a few details. What's your name?
Maria Gentle.
And your address, Maria?
Well, I'm a student staying with a family in Newcastle.
So it's care of...
Care of Mr. and Mrs. McDonald.
Like the hamburgers?
Yes, exactly.
McDonald.
The post office box address is probably best. It's P.O. Box 676, Newcastle.
Is there a fax number there? Because I could fax you the information.
Yes, actually there is. It's 0249, that's for Newcastle, and then 775431.
Okay, now if you decide to do one of our courses, you'll need to book in advance and to pay when you book. How would you be paying?
By credit card, if that's okay. Do you take Visa?
Yes, fine. We take all major cards, including Visa.
Okay then. Thanks very much.
The girl is telling her friend about the course. Look at questions 8 to 10. Now listen to their conversation and answer questions 8 to 10.
Hi, Pauline.
Hi, Maria. What's that you're reading?
Just some information from a paragliding school. It looks really good fun. Do you fancy a go at paragliding?
Sure. Do you have to buy lots of equipment and stuff?
Not really. The school provides the equipment, but we'd have to take a few things along.
Such as?
Well, it says here, clothes, wear stout boots, so no sneakers or sandals, I suppose. And clothes suitable for an active day in the hills. Preferably a long-sleeve T-shirt. That's probably in case you land in the stinging nettles. It also says we should bring a packed lunch. We do not recommend soft drinks or flasks of coffee. Water is really the best thing to drink. We need to bring suntan lotion and something to protect your head from the sun.
Okay, that sounds reasonable. And where would we stay?
Well, look, they seem to operate a campsite too, because it says here that it's only $10 a day to pitch a tent. That'd be fine, wouldn't it? And that way we'd save quite a bit, because even a cheap hotel would cost money.
Or perhaps we could stay in a bed and breakfast nearby. It gives a couple of names here we could ring. I think I might prefer that. Hotels and youth hostels would all be miles away from the farm, and I don't fancy a caravan.
No, I agree. But let's take a 10 and pray for good weather.
Okay, let's do it. What about next weekend?
No, I can't. I'm going on a geography field trip.
And then it's the weekend before the exams, and I really do need to study.
Okay, then. Let's make it the one after the exams.
Fine. We'll need a break by then. Can you ring and let me know if you can find out some...
That is the end of section one. You now have half a minute to check your answers. You will hear a reporter talking on the radio about old racing cars. First, look at questions 11 to 16. As you listen to the first part of the talk, answer questions 11 to 16.
The Goodwood Museum is currently celebrating some of the most extravagant types of car design in its Festival of Speed. Here's our reporter, Vincent Fried, who's on site to tell us about some of the cars on display.
Well, here I am, standing in front of one of the most prestigious cars ever built, the Duesenberg. A fantastically expensive, luxurious car built in the early part of the 20th century and bearing all the glamorous qualities of the Jazz Age. How many were there? Well, only 473 Duesenberg J-types were ever built, and the model here is one of the rarest. Each had a short 125-inch chassis or framework, and the body was always in the form of an open two-seater. The technology behind the car's 6.9-litre engine was extraordinary. It featured capsules of mercury in the engines to absorb vibration and provide an incredibly smooth ride. In fact, these cars offered unparalleled performance. In an age when 160 kilometres per hour was considered very fast, the Duesenberg promised a top speed of 180 kilometres per hour. And could do 140 kilometers per hour in second gear. Duesenberg, who designed the car, sold it as a frame and engine. This was typical of the age again, and many prestige manufacturers such as Rolls-Royce did exactly the same. Owners able to afford the hefty $9,000 price tag for the basic car would then commission a coachwork company to build a body tailored to their own individual requirements. The Duesenberg's great attraction for the driver was its instrument panel, which offered all the usual features, but also several others, including a stopwatch. It was the Duesenberg's technology that lay behind its success as a racing car, and they dominated the American racing scene in the 1920s, winning the Indianapolis Grand Prix in 1924, 25, and 27.
Now look at questions 17 to 20. As the talk continues, answer questions 17 to 20.
On to another celebrity, the 1922 Leia Helica. Only 30 of these French propeller cars were built, and the model here at Goodwood, which was the fourth to be made, is thought to be the only surviving example still capable of running. The brains behind this car was Marcel Leia, who was an aviation pioneer first and foremost, and the influence of flying is quite apparent in the car. The Leia very strongly resembles a light aircraft with its front propeller, but in this case, it's minus any wings, of course. It's quite odd to think that this car was whirring through France just as the Duesenberg was blasting down roads at 160 kilometers per hour across the Atlantic. The layers were used regularly in France in the 1920s and were even produced in saloon and van form, as well as two-seater. The layer matched its propeller drive with its equally bizarre steering, which used the rear rather than the front wheels. But despite looking rather frail, it was a tough machine. In fact, when troops tried to steal it during the Second World War, the car's baffling design was clearly beyond the would-be thieves, and it ended up being driven into a tree, breaking the propeller. And now for the Firebird. This extraordinary car was first...
That is the end of section two. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Section 3. You will hear two students discussing a project they have to do as part of a literature course on great books. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25 on page 12. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
Hi, Joey. How are you doing? I heard you were sick.
Oh, hi, Olivia. Yeah, I had a virus last week, and I missed a whole pile of lectures, like the first one on the great books and literature, where Dr. Castle gave us all the information about the semester project.
I can give you copies of the handouts. I've got them right here.
But that's okay. I already collected the handouts, but I'm not very clear about all the details. I know we each have to choose an individual author. I think I'm going to do Carlos Castaneda. I'm really interested in South American literature.
Have you checked he's on the list that Dr. Castle gave us? We can't just choose anyone.
Yeah, I checked. It's okay. Who did you choose?
Well, I was thinking of choosing Ernest Hemingway, but then I thought, no, I'll do a British author, not an American one. So I chose Emily Bronte.
Okay. And first of all, it says we have to read a biography of our author. I guess it's okay if we just look up information about him on the internet?
No, it's got to be a full-length book. I think the minimum length's 250 pages. There's a list of biographies. Didn't you get that?
Oh, right. I didn't realize we had to stick with that. So what do we have to do when we've read the biography?
Well, then we have to choose one work by the writer. Again, it's got to be something quite long. We can't just read a short story.
But I guess a collection of short stories would be okay?
Yes, or even a collection of poems, they said. But I think most people are doing novels. I'm going to do Wuthering Heights. I've read it before, but I really want to read it again now I've found out more about the writer.
And then the video. We have to make a short video about our author and about the book. How long has it got to be?
A minute.
What? Like 60 seconds? And we got to give all the important information about their life and the book we choose?
Well, you can't do everything. I wrote it down somewhere. Yes, Dr. Castle said we had to find or write a short passage that helps to explain the author's passion for writing, why they're a writer. So we can back this up with reference to important events in the writer's life, if they're relevant. But it's up to us, really. The video's meant to portray the essence of the writer's life and the piece of writing we choose.
So when we read the biography, we have to think about what kind of person our writer is.
Yes, and the historical context and so on. So for my writer, Emily Bronte, the biography gave a really strong impression of the place where she lived and the countryside around.
Right. I'm beginning to get the idea.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 26 to 30 on page 13. Now listen and answer questions 26 to 30.
Can I check the other requirements with you?
Sure.
The handout said after we'd read the biography, we had to read the work we'd chosen by our author and choose a passage that's typical in some way, that typifies the author's interests and style.
Yes, but at the same time, it has to relate to the biographical extract you choose. There's got to be some sort of theme linking them.
Okay, I'm with you.
And then you have to think about the video.
So are we meant to dramatize the scene we choose?
I guess we could, but there's not a lot of time for that. I think it's more how we can use things like sound effects to create the atmosphere, the feeling we want.
And presumably visuals as well?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I suppose that's the whole point of making a video. But whatever we use has to be historically in keeping with the author. We can use things like digital image processing to do it all.
So we can use any computer software we want?
Sure. And it's important that we use a range, not just one software program. That's actually one of the things we're assessed on.
Okay.
Oh, and something else that's apparently really important is to keep track of the materials we use and to acknowledge them.
Including stuff we download off the internet, presumably?
Yeah, so our video has to list all the material used with details of the source in a bibliography at the end.
Okay. And you were talking about assessment of the project. Did they give us the criteria? I couldn't find anything on the handout.
Sure. He gave us them in the lecture. Let's see, you get 25% just for getting all the components done. That's both sets of reading and the video. Then the second part is actually how successful we are at getting the essence of the work. They call that content, and that counts for 50%. Then the last 25% is on the video itself, the artistic and technical side.
Great. Well, that sounds a lot of work, but a whole lot better than just handing in a paper. Thanks a lot, Olivia.
You're welcome.
That is the end of Section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 4, on page 14. Section 4. You will hear a speaker giving a talk about some recent research about unusual life forms. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40, on pages 14 and 15. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the sixth of our ecology evening classes. Nice to see you all again. As you know from the programme, today I want to talk to you about some research that is pushing back the frontiers of the whole field of ecology. And this research is being carried out in the remoter regions of our planet, places where the environment is harsh and, until recently, it was thought that the conditions couldn't sustain life of any kind. But life forms are being found, and these have been grouped into what is now known as extremophiles. That is, organisms that can survive in the most extreme environments. And these discoveries may be setting a huge challenge for the scientists of the future, as you'll see in a minute. Now, the particular research I want to tell you about was carried out in Antarctica, one of the coldest and driest places on Earth. But a multinational team of researchers from the US, Canada, and New Zealand recently discovered colonies of microbes in the soil there where no one thought it was possible. Interestingly enough, some of the colonies were identified as a type of fungus called Bouveria bassiana, a fungus that lives on insects. But where are the insects in these utterly empty regions of Antarctica? The researchers concluded that this was clear evidence that these colonies were certainly not new arrivals. They might have been there for centuries, or even millennia, possibly even since the last ice age. Can you imagine their excitement? Now, some types of microbes had previously been found living just a few millimetres under the surface of rocks, porous Antarctic rocks. But this was the first time that living colonies had been found surviving, relatively deeply in the soil itself, several centimetres down, in fact. So, the big question is, how can these colonies survive there? Well, we know that the organisms living very near the rock's surface can still be warmed by the sun, so they can survive in their own microclimate. And this keeps them from freezing during the day. But this isn't the case for the colonies that are hidden under the soil. In their research paper, this team suggested that the very high amounts of salt in the soil might be the clue. Because this is what is preventing essential water from freezing. The team found that the salt concentration increased the deeper down they went in the soil. But while they had expected the number of organisms to be fewer down there, they actually found the opposite. In soil that had as much as 3,000 parts of salt per million, relatively high numbers of microbes were present, which seems incredible. But the point is that at those levels of salt, the temperature could drop to minus 56 degrees before frost would cause any damage to the organisms. This relationship between microbes and salt, at temperatures way below the normal freezing point of water, is a really significant breakthrough. As you all know, life is dependent on the availability of water in liquid form, and the role of salt at very low temperatures could be the key to survival in these kinds of conditions. Now, the process at work here is called supercooling, and that's usually written as one word, but it isn't really understood as yet, so there's a lot more for researchers to work on. However, the fact that this process occurs naturally in Antarctica may suggest that it might occur in other places with similar conditions, including on our neighbouring planet, Mars. So, you can start to see the wider implications of this kind of research. In short, it appears to support the growing belief that extraterrestrial life might be able to survive the dry, cold conditions on other planets after all. Not only does this research produce evidence that life is possible there, it's also informing scientists of the locations where it might be found. So all of this might have great significance for future unmanned space missions. One specialist on Mars confirms the importance of the
That is the end of Section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the separate answer sheet.